We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Welcome to Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And Overnight America continues with another special guest. We've just had so many great guests tonight. He is the author of Saving the Electoral College, Why the National Popular Vote Would Undermine Democracy, author Robert Hardaway. You were on a couple of months ago. Thanks for coming back to KMOX.
Well, I'm glad to come back. Spread the word whenever possible.
There was a big Supreme Court hearing, or at least a decision that came down yesterday. Sometimes the days blur, and it had to do with the faithless electors in some of the different states and those that try to vote away from the way that their people they represent are, end up voting. And the idea is just trying to undercut the Electoral College. Now, the Supreme Court didn't necessarily address that per se, but I wanted to get your thoughts on the Supreme Court decision that did come down.
Yes, I wrote the amicus brief for that case, and my brief was mentioned during the oral argument. I think that I was pretty convinced that we had a very good case. It was 9-0. Every one of the justices agreed that a state has the right under Article 2 of the Constitution to regulate and determine the methods of qualifying electors. And one of the requirements in Colorado is that they vote for the person they promised to vote for. So when you go into the voting booth, many people are actually quite uninformed about what they do when they go into voting booth. They think they're voting for a candidate, Trump or Hillary, whoever. But they're really not. They're voting for an elector who says, if you vote for me, I promise to go to the Electoral College and vote for the candidate of your choice. But what happens if they don't do it? And this is what's problem. That's one big problem with the NPVIC. They want to let the newspapers decide who wins the popular vote by answering the question. Well, let's give an example. Let's say that in the 2016 election, we had had the NPVIC, that's the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, by which states would agree to cast their votes, electoral votes, in accordance with a quote popular vote around the country. But how do you count popular votes for an elector such as Mr. Baca in 2016, who said, I'm not going to vote for Hillary, I'm going to vote for a Republican instead? How do you count that if you're trying to tally up popular votes? You count it as 136,000 votes for Hillary or for Trump? There's no way to do it. So it's really based on an illusion. And the newspapers and the media kind of foster this illusion, because when you watch TV on election night, it says at the bottom, popular votes for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. And it's not popular votes for them. So there's no way to calculate it. It's kind of just an exercise in political theater, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I didn't know that you actually wrote and actually you go and did you actually go in front of the Supreme Court, or how does it work when they're all working from home?
Well, they did. It was remote. They didn't want to get involved with live arguments. I wrote an amicus brief, which is a brief that actually any organization can submit, but they decide which ones they're going to accept. And it's a difficult process. And my amicus brief made the case that voters have a right to not be defrauded. That voters have a right when they vote, go in the voting booth and think they're voting for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, that the person that the elector they're voting for will actually carry out their will. and not just vote on a whim. And 32 states have laws requiring that electors reflect the will of the people in their state.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'm wondering when that is so cool that the Supreme Court would even acknowledge that. So did you get a chance to hear their response to your essay?
Well, they referenced at one point, they did reference my amicus brief, sort of obliquely, but they did mention it. And I was gratified because all of my arguments they accepted, basically, which is that it just doesn't make any sense to disenfranchise 138,000 people, voters, who voted for the Hillary elector, who then turned around and said, well, I'm gonna violate my oath. I'm not going to vote for the person that I promised to vote for. I'm going to vote for somebody else. And that is really a betrayal of the voters who believe that they were voting for Hillary Clinton. And to this day, if you ask people on the street, did you vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? They'll tell you, yeah, I voted for Hillary Clinton. They did not. They did not do anything of the sort. But they still
technicalities.
Believe.
But one other thing that you mentioned here, maybe we do this here in a moment, but the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, the NPVIC, that is something that they didn't necessarily vote on or make a decision on, which means that is still kind of on the back burner. And that's something that I think they will have to address at some point. Do you feel that will be maybe their next move?
Well, the question is when it's ripe. About two-thirds of the states necessary to reach 270 have bought into this NPVIC scheme. It's interesting, back in 2003, they first tried to pass it in the Colorado legislature. I went down there and I explained to them they were 10-1 in favor of this NPVIC. And after they let me make the arguments that I'm making to you now, they reversed their decision to 10-1 against. But then last summer, some 10 years later, like a bad penny, it came back through the back door and they tried to get it through again. But this time there were mobs of people down there. And I listened to them for several hours, and virtually all of them had only one argument in favor of the NPVIC. They said, we need it because if we don't have it, then we don't elect the person that we wanted. So that was basically their argument. They had absolutely no argument based on history, based on the Constitution, based on what's required, and certainly no understanding of what the NPVIC is. It's basically a cabal of states that agree to circumvent the Constitution and defer to the so-called popular votes in other states. So they let's say that in Colorado, they voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. The Colorado legislature would say, we don't care who you voted for. We're going to see who the media thinks got the most popular votes in other states. Each state has different standard for counting votes. And, of course, there is no popular vote to hang their hat on. It's basically an exercise in political theater.
So the book is Saving the Electoral College, Why the National Popular Vote Would Undermine Democracy, author Robert Hardaway. Do you mind holding on after the break?
Sure.
I have a couple of other questions for you, and we'll talk about the Electoral College in general, and maybe it'd be good to give another pitch of why it's so effective, why it's a good system. We'll continue our conversation with Robert Hardaway coming up next on Overnight America, KMOX.
St. Louis's Morning News, Total Information AM, weekday mornings at 5 on KMOX and KMOX.com.
He writes about the Electoral College, and you can find his book, Saving the Electoral College, Why the National Popular Vote Would Undermine Democracy, online. And author Robert Hardaway continues with us. And thanks again for spending some time with us tonight. I really do appreciate it.
I'm very pleased. Very pleased to get the word out.
So I'm going to ask you this question, and this is, I guess it's somewhat of a loaded question, but what's so great about the Electoral College anyway?
Well, it's more likely to give you a president who's supported by the majority of the people. The so-called national popular vote, if we got rid of the Electoral College, that's basically the Russian system and also the French system. And the French system, their voters back in 2017 learned the hard way what happens when you don't have an Electoral College. They had four or five candidates, the two major parties. It was split between four or five big parties. One party got 23%, one got 21%, the other two were split 19%. And then they had a runoff between two people Macron with 23% and Le Pen with 21%. And two-thirds of the electorate opposed both of them. And they expressed their outrage for this so-called national popular vote system, the Russian system, by casting over 1 million blank ballots. That's what happens when you don't have an Electoral College. The Electoral College channels votes. You don't have these silly runoffs where one person's guaranteed to win 50%, even though they're opposed by two-thirds of the electorate. And interestingly, John F. Kennedy was the one who pointed this out back in 1956 in the Senate. Now, whatever you might think of JFK, in other ways, he understood his constitution. He pointed out that a direct election of the type that they use in France and in Russia would greatly increase the likelihood of a minority president, that is, a president who got a minority of the votes. It would break down the federal system under which the states entered the Union, which provides a system of checks and balances that ensure that no area or group shall obtain too much power. So that's why we've had it, and that's why we've had such a successful country with a lot of stability. Countries that don't have it, look at something, a country like Italy, where they don't have an electoral college, and you have 16 governments in 14 years. And if you don't have stability, you can never have a good economy. Not as strong.
So, Robert Hardaway, what do you got against dictatorships anyway?
I'm not saying France is a dictatorship. They just wound up with a president who was opposed by two-thirds of the people, and that's what happens. The beautiful channeling effect of the Electoral College is that, you know, once a candidate, let's say a Green Party candidate, can get 8%, well, I'll give you an example. In the 1930s, the Socialist Party had something like polling at 9%. But as they got closer to the election, they realized under the Electoral College, you have to have a plurality in a single state before you get a single electoral vote. And they realized we're not going to get a single electoral vote. So they made an accommodation with the Democratic Party. And so that's why we have a two-party system. In states in countries which don't have that, you end up with the catastrophe that you have in other countries that don't have one, which is a president who's opposed by two-thirds of the people.
Yeah. What happened after the Supreme Court decision came out? Did you celebrate?
Well, I did. I thought it would be 7-2. It was a 9-0 decision. I thought I think the Supreme Court realized what the purpose of this was. They called themselves the Hamilton electors, and they have this highfalutin notion that the drafters of the Constitution thought that electors should be able to do anything that they wanted, and they couldn't be bound by the will of the people. I don't think they really believe that. I don't think the Harvard professor who led the way on that argument really believed it. I think most people realized that they wanted to show that the Electoral College was ridiculous, because anyone could just, on a whim, ignore the will of the people in their own state. And that didn't happen. They realized, because, you know, back in the 2016 election, people started to think, well, maybe we could have a second election. Maybe we could convince the electors, bribe them, intimidate them to change their votes and to ignore the will of the people in their state. And, you know, people don't want a second election in late December. They want to know who won in November on the day of election. They don't want the instability that would be caused. And so I think the Supreme Court realized that that's not a good thing, to have a second election in which electors can be intimidated and threatened, people calling in willing to pay their fines for violating their oaths and so on. It's just it's an invitation to a constitutional crisis.
So your book is Saving the Electoral College, Why the National Popular Vote Would Undermine Democracy. If they wanted to find that book, where would you tell them to go?
Well, you can go to ABC-CLIO, ABC-CLIO. They have a website, and you can order the book there. I will also say that all the money, any royalties I get from this, I use to buy copies of the books to send to legislators in the states who are going to be hit with this proposal, this NBVIC proposal. And I know that when they see the arguments there, they change their votes, because when I went down to the Colorado legislature back in 2003, they were so appalled by the whole idea of it that they switched their votes from 10-1 in favor of it to 10-1 against.
Wow, that's pretty impressive that you spent your money to give copies to legislators to try to help the cause there. So it's an interesting time because back in 2016, this became a very popular type of discussion point online. It's good that people know and understand the Electoral College, why it's in place and why it's important to keep it in place.
And they've forgotten what they learned in sixth grade civics. They don't forgot the last sentence of Article 5, which says that every state is guaranteed two senators, and that only you can't change that by constitutional amendment. The draft just put that in there to as a kind of a poison pill against future demagogues trying to change the Constitution by constitutional amendment. And of course, those two electors that every state gets is reflected in the Electoral College. Every state, Wyoming, every state gets at least three electors, two of which are based on equal suffrage in the Senate. And you can't abolish that unless every state agrees, according to the last sentence of Article 5. And that is the basis of the Electoral College. The U.S. Senate and the Electoral College are intertwined as part of the grand compromise that created the United States of America. Without it, there would have been no Constitution, because the two states, the two parts of the country, the small states, said, we're not going to participate in the country where we don't have equal suffrage in the Senate. And the other big states said, no, we're not going to participate in the country unless we have one person, one vote. And it was Benjamin Franklin who at the last minute said, hey, here's a compromise. Let's do both. Brought the country together. Without it, we'd be sort of like South America now, because the country was already breaking up. Wow. At that time, George III said they're never going to get their act together. They're not going to have a one nation. So it really did create the United States of America. And a lot of people just don't realize the history of the Electoral College and how it bound us together in one nation.
Well, again, if people wanted to find Saving the Electoral College, where would you direct them?
ABC-Clio, which is the publishing house, and it's a conglomerate publishing house in Santa Barbara. They can also go, of course, find it on Amazon.
Right. And I got to say, Robert Hardaway, this is always a good discussion. I know I had you on probably late last year when the book was still nice and fresh, and it's still very relevant after the Supreme Court ruling. So thank you again for coming back on to Overnight America.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Robert Hardaway, the author of Saving the Electoral College. You can go give that a look up. He joins us on the TDK Technologies guest line. And our friend Brad Young from Harris Dahl Fisher & Young. A look at the Supreme Court decision from earlier today when it comes to religious institutions. It's Overnight America, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
News Radio 1120, KMOX, the voice of the Cardinals.
Here on Overnight America, we take things very seriously. That's why we bring on Brad Young from Harris Dahl Fisher & Young to break down the big news stories of the day, break down complex legal issues, and the Supreme Court is always a good source of content. Brad, thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Good evening, but I don't know if I'm supposed to call you Ryan or Mike.
Oh, no. Did he tell you to say that, or did you come up with that?
No, it was, listen, I'm always listening to Overnight America.
Oh, no. We were wondering, producer Mike, during the break, theorized, I wonder if he'll say something like that, and there it is. So the Supreme Court keeping busy, and in fact, we just had Robert Hardaway on in the last segment, and he actually wrote, what's that brief he wrote, amicus brief or something like that, as part of the one Electoral College summary that came back, so that was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's a friend of the court brief where you write briefs in order to be, if you have a high level of expertise in something, then the court wants those individuals to write briefs, not that they have a stake in the outcome, but sort of as an expert testimony.
You know, if the Supreme Court ever brings up Star Trek, I better believe you would write one of those for them.
I would be the lead author of the amicus brief. You can count on it.
Well, the Supreme Court keeps pumping out the hits, and one of them today was regarding insurance when it comes to religious institutions, schools, things like that. This is kind of an interesting one because it goes to an organization that petitioned this before. It's the Little Sisters of the Poor, and they challenged the Obamacare contraception clause or whatever was part of Obamacare. And I was hoping you could give us an idea of what happened today in that decision.
Well, in that particular decision, the question was whether private companies, in this instance a school, whether they are forced to provide contraceptions under the Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. And what the Supreme Court held in a 7-2 decision, I mean, it wasn't even that close of a decision, but what they held was that the Trump administration, because about 2 years ago, the Trump administration signed what's called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was really just an executive order that prevented organizations, or rather they had to, they ordered organizations to take in religious liberties into consideration. And one of those things was to allow companies to opt out of the Obamacare provision, which requires providing contraception free of charge to employees. And so the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that the Trump administration was clearly within its rights to exercise their executive power to allow companies to be exempted from that provision.
That's a pretty big deal. And, you know, I got to go back and just on a practical standpoint when it comes to contraceptive, I think very rarely used as a medical treatment, and it's primarily used as something other than that. So you can see why some religious institutions would not want to associate themselves with something that would go against their religious beliefs. And the Little Sisters of the Poor, or the organization that was really in the forefront of this, you can see why an organization like that would have some objections to it, that they would not want to be associating themselves with something that would go against what their religious beliefs are. And rightfully so. I'm glad the Supreme Court voted the way they did.
Well, I am too, but here's what's interesting about it. A lot of times we think of Supreme Court decisions as being long-lasting precedent. You know, just last week you and I had a very interesting conversation regarding Chief Justice John Roberts' view of precedent and what is precedent and how does it work. But in this particular case, it was entirely based on the ability of the executive branch to offer those exemptions to the Affordable Care Act. Now, the next administration, if it looks the other way and thinks that organizations should be required to provide contraception, then the next president could sign an executive order going the exact opposite way. So this isn't something that's going to be lasting or have precedential value over years or decades. It truly is ephemeral. I mean, it only lasts as long as this administration is there, and the next administration could take the exact opposite approach.
Well, sure, this is something that could be looked at as narrow, and you can look at it as contraception, but at least it shows that the Supreme Court, when it comes to ruling, if you are going to petition them, that they do take into mind that religious freedom is something that needs to be upheld. So other future challenges, it would at least indicate that the way that the structure of the Supreme Court is today would probably be favorable to keeping religious freedom, and that's probably a good sign.
It is a good sign, and there have been several cases from the Supreme Court this term protecting religious freedom. I'm glad to see that, and I hope that's a trend that we'll see continue, particularly when you have a 7-2 decision. It's not like it's a 5-4, and it was a very narrow case, and you know somebody flipped a coin before they went into the room. I mean, it wasn't any of those kinds of things. This was a pretty substantial victory when you have a 7-2 decision.
And one other thing, I wanted to read that headline from the LA Times. How, this is the headline, it says, it's an op-ed piece, how the idea of religious freedom is being used to undermine other rights. So, and the people that would oppose this decision today from the Supreme Court, they look at this and say, the religious freedom undermines other rights. That's the approach that they're taking for something like this. Do you get a chance to see that op-ed?
I did. I read that, and it's a very interesting piece, and it's a very thought-provoking piece, because religious freedom is really something that is historically enormously important, not only just to Americans in general, but to the courts in particular. And one of the things that occurred to me, Ryan, as I was reading that piece, is there was one phrase that the author of the LA Times op-ed piece said, and he talked about the erosion of principles of religious freedom that require the separation of church and state. And that's really the genesis of that objection, because there is nothing in our Constitution that requires the separation of church and state. In fact, that phrase didn't exist in any publication or any court decision until 1947, and then it was in a dissenting opinion written by perhaps one of the most liberal Supreme Court justices of all time, Hugo Black. And so this idea of separation of church and state, if you look historically, the framers of the Constitution were more concerned with the government affecting churches and religion than they were with religion having an impact on government. But yet, after 1947, that view has been completely twisted to now the idea and the concept in popular culture is that there's this wall of separation between of church and state, when in reality, that's not in the Constitution, nor was it designed to be a part of the Constitution.
Yeah, it's a tough battle, and there are a lot of instances where people have these deeply held religious beliefs, these things where they're going to have to choose between being punished by the government or somehow being in bad favor with their Lord, and that's a very difficult thing, because if the government's trying to punish you in that way, then do you really have a separation? Is there really some sort of protection against the government when it comes to your religious beliefs? And the answer, I don't think, would be there. So that's why you need to have religious freedom. That's why there's a lot of other ways to look at it. But one other thing I wanted to ask you, I know you keep your ear to the ground. You listen to a lot of people, and tomorrow is a big one. The Supreme Court is going to put down their decision regarding Trump's tax records. And I'm wondering if you're hearing anything or any indication of how they might rule on that one.
I do. I can summarize it pretty quickly. There's actually two different cases that are involved that have been merged into one case that the Supremes will be deciding tomorrow. And that is, the one case deals with whether the House of Representatives can obtain Trump's tax records. And the second issue is whether the Attorney General, or rather the State's Attorney in New York City, Cyrus Vance Jr., whether he can subpoena Trump's tax records for use in a grand jury hearing. And so what I think you're going to find tomorrow is that, at least my prediction on it, is that the Supreme Court will, to again use a religious phrase, will split the baby and be a Solomon here, and they will probably, at least in my opinion, rule in favor of President Trump on the issue of whether the House of Representatives can obtain those tax records, because there's no legitimate reason why the House of Representatives needs those records other than for political purposes. And the Supreme Court has held many, many, many times that Congress can't take action against the executive branch for something that's a purely political purpose. And but on the flip side, I think that the court will rule that Cyrus Vance, the state's attorney in New York City, can obtain those tax records for grand jury purposes only, which effectively means those records won't see the light of day until well into next year.
Interesting. So let's say, hypothetically, that it goes the other way, it goes the opposite way, and President Trump ends up losing this and he has to release his tax records. Is there any recourse for him to block that from happening, or is it just, hey, the Supreme Court made the ruling, it's got to go?
Well, then it sets up what's called a constitutional crisis. The last time we really had something like this was in 1973 with Nixon and Watergate. But President Trump could simply say, I'm not going to give up my tax records. But the problem is that the subpoenas that are the focus of this litigation are directed to Deutsche Bank and President Trump's accounting firm. So even if he says, I'm not going to give you it, and, you know, I'm going to hold my breath and turn blue and I'm not going to give you my tax records, even if he says that, Deutsche Bank can say, well, listen, if the Supreme Court says we got to give them up, we're going to give them up. And I don't see how President Trump could block that.
Oh, interesting. Since they're a foreign entity, do they even have to comply with our Supreme Court?
Well, they do if they want to do business in the United States. And I would think that they do want to do business in the United States. So yeah. I think that they would comply. But what's interesting is these records really aren't under President Trump's control. So as much as he may not want to cooperate with whatever the Supreme Court says or doesn't say, it's really not in his hands.
Yeah, it's too bad you weren't filling in this week. This would have been the best week for you to be doing the show with all the Supreme Court decisions. So you're actually going to be filling in for me in a couple of ways and starting next Wednesday? Is that your first night?
Yeah, there's going to be two or three nights while you're gone. I'll be filling in for you. I'll be sitting in the big chair. But we talk about lots of things, not just legal issues, but all kinds of things.
It'll be great, and I'm looking forward to it. And Brad Young, thank you so much for coming on tonight to Overnight America.
My pleasure, Mike.
Oh, no. I'm keeping a tally. That's like, let's see, 5, 6, or 7 times that's happened total tonight. Brad Young joins us on the TDK Technologies guest line on Overnight America KMOX.
This is Overnight America, sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com on KMOX.
Yeah, you heard it. I'm going to be off a couple of days here in the next few weeks. So I'm going to Michigan, and I'm going to be part of a friend's wedding. So I'm pretty excited. I'll actually be in Michigan this time next week. So I'm going to be off on Wednesday, Thursday, Sunday, and Monday of next week, the 15th, 16th, and then 19th and 20th, that Monday and Sunday and Monday. So I will miss you. That's true. It is a true thing. I will miss you, but you'll be in great hands with Brad Young, and I'm not sure who else will be filling in. Also, the following week, that means I'll be off on that Sunday, Monday, but then I'll be back on Tuesday and Wednesday, the 21st and 22nd. Then I'm off on the 24th and then the entire following week because I'll be filling in on our sister station on 97.1. I do that every once in a while. It's a fun thing for me to do. It's cool when they invite me to do it, and it's nice to do different shows every once in a while. It's a good opportunity for me to plug this show. Yeah. I'm shameless. I'll go on to someone else's show, and I'll try to use it as a way to promote Overnight America, but I'm not exactly sure who's filling in. I know Brad will probably do some of those days, just not sure which ones, so we'll have to keep you up to date on that. I wanted to give you this one crazy story before we get to the news. This is an absolutely insane story, and it's out of New Jersey. City of Passaic, during a flash flood warning, something insane happened. A woman escaped her car as part of this flash flooding. She gets stuck up in this water, which is, again, do I need to remind you, when there is flash flooding or any type of water where you can't see the ground, do not drive your car through it. It is a dumb move. So many people lose their lives that way. They underestimate how deep the waters are and get themselves into some serious trouble. So Natalia, 24 years old, attempted to drive through deep water in a Pontiac. It just happened. The woman got into a tide, got stuck, and got taken away into a viaduct. Okay. She escaped her car, pulled her from a vehicle, and then the water just took her. When it floods, it floods. What ended up happening next is absolutely insane. The water was rushing. She got sucked into a drainage and then got through like a giant crazy water ride, went through a mile-long drainage tube, sucked up in this water from the flash flooding, like it's an insane amusement park. So there she is, not having the time of her life, scared to death, because at any given moment, imagine this, what if you get stuck in an area where there is no way to breathe? And then you're in the middle of a tube and no one could get to you, you're dead, guaranteed, dead. Well, that's not and what ended up happening. She may be the luckiest woman on the face of the earth. It's miraculous, they said. She goes through a mile-long drainage tube and gets popped out the other side and survives. This is like out of the Goonies or something crazy like that. This is something that only happens in the movies. Survives a drainage ditch ride through flash flooding. Don't try this at home, kids. I saw that one on USA Today in New Jersey. Wow, what a crazy, crazy story. Just another reminder, do not drive your car through flash flooding. Such a bad idea. We're going to talk a little COVID, the response, opening schools. Are we in good shape? Are we in bad shape? We'll take some of your calls on that, too. And Missouri teachers are concerned about coming back into work, and rightfully so. We'll talk about that story. 314-436-7900. We're going to open up the phone lines. I had a lot of interviews, but this last hour, it's all yours on Overnight America KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.